The crucial feature of gaslighting is the blatant telling of lies again and again and again in a way that makes the listener start to question their own reality, right? If Donald Trump is saying these untruths so confidently and so repeatedly, we start to worry about whether what we think is true actually is true. In the original movie, it's about the gas lights are flickering and the wife insists that these lights keep flickering, and her husband, who is causing the lights to flicker, just denies it and convinces her that she's going insane.
The voice of Jeffrey Howard, a lecturer in political theory. You might have noticed the word gaslight popping up in the news recently. Well, we'll take a look at the 1944 film that coined the term today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Well, you know, obviously the Golden Globes and Meryl Streep talking, that's a huge public venue. That's a nationally broadcast award show, and so that's a huge microphone.
Film critic at New Republic magazine Tim Grierson looks at why film festivals and award ceremonies are stacking their guest lists with people not afraid to stoke a little bit of controversy and speak their mind. And are you a fan of German comedy?
Sometimes it's just down to when a film is scheduled and there being a nice kind of synchronicity to that. I kind of have a little kind of Nixon's black book of films I want to put on the cover that I kind of keep with me at all times.
I'll sit down with the editor of Little White Lies magazine, David Jenkins, to discuss the new film Tony Erdmann, which is, quite frankly, unlike just about anything else. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Yeah, it's always nice to see you. You know, let's take a chance to see each other. We're very happy to be here. Thank you, Sundance. Thank you for this invitation. Thank you for bringing us here into this...
That's the Mexican actor Gael Garcia Bernal presenting at the awards ceremony of this year's Sundance Film Festival. Welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. With American politics reaching new levels of surreal this week, it's little wonder that some of the tension is being reflected at the various artistic celebrations taking place around the world right now. From the Screen Actors Guild Awards to film festivals in Rotterdam and Berlin. And Sundance was no exception.
And today especially, today, I'm from Iraq, from Iran, from Syria, and from many other countries as well. You know, it's so obvious that we're so interdependent and that we're so interconnected, and that we, with everything we do, with every expression, with every single moment that we share with each other, that we think about each other. In Peru, for example, there is this ceremony that's called the Pachamama, no? Ceremony. And what they tell you is to think about the mountain where you come from. And that mountain where you come from, if you think about it, is also another person's mountain as well. And this leads me to tell you that when you think about that in a very subtle and concentrated way, you find yourself in the world, in the center of the world, all of a sudden. And I invite you, on behalf of everyone from Mexico, from my family from Guadalajara, from Sinaloa, from Michoacán, from all the people, from my kids, from all my Argentinian family, my Colombian family, my Lebanese family, my Cuban family, I invite you all to come to Mexico.
Gael Garcia Bernal is just one of several celebrated names in the arts who have spoken out in recent days. Tim Grierson is a film critic at the New Republic magazine in New York. Tim, were you surprised by some of the voices who spoke out?
I would say I'm not surprised, because I think that Sundance, because it sort of caters to independent-minded artists, those are the types of artists I think that will always want to feel like they're contributing to society beyond just the work that they make, that they want to make a real impact. I mean, the festival was founded by Robert Redford, and Redford for a long time has been interested in environmental causes, for example. And so I think the spirit of Sundance is very much about activism and speaking out about political issues. So no, it seemed like in some ways sort of the perfect venue to talk about what's going on in the world.
Is there a difference then when someone gets a little bit political at an event like Sundance? Is there a difference between that and maybe being a little political in your acceptance speech at something like the Golden Globes or the Oscars?
Well, you know, obviously the Golden Globes and Meryl Streep talking for her Cecil B. DeMille Award, that's a huge public venue. That's a nationally broadcast award show. And so that's a huge microphone for someone like Streep. Whereas I think Sundance, you know, it's a smaller type of thing. That's not, that award show is not broadcast. And so it's not something that as many people will see. But I think that especially, and I think we're going to see this at the Oscars this month as well, I think in an environment where people are giving out awards, the recipients of those awards, I think, have a difficult time talking about the fact that talking about their achievements and being honored for something and being excited about being awarded something at the same time when there's so many things in the world that are, frankly, very frightening going on. Melanie Lynskey, who was part of the cast of the Grand Jury Prize winner this year, talked about this a little bit on Twitter. She was so happy that her film won the Grand Jury Prize, and she was so proud of the movie and her work in it. But at the same time, because there are so many, between the Muslim ban, between other things that Trump has done, it's hard to be in an entirely revelatory mood. And so I think because of that, people who win awards, people who have kind of a megaphone, they feel like they should say something because they don't want to act as if they're not aware of what's going on in the wider world. And so I think between Sundance and the Golden Globes, you're going to be seeing more and more of this.
Yeah, my hopes are that this brings us together as people, period, not as a people, not as Black people, not as white, but as people, and understand that the only thing that's going to make anything change is for us to love each other. Seriously, and now I mean like mushy love, and I mean like take care of ourselves first, take care of our lives, take care of our businesses, take care of our children, take care of everything that we think that the, you know, he might be able to give us, you know, the government might be able to give us or whatever. We have to take it. We have to take care of ourselves. And I mean, I hate speaking like this, but it's the truth, you know. And I hope that it brings us all together and uplifts us and awakes us instead of, you know, breaking us. It's a
really difficult. Mary J. Blige speaking to the Associated Press. She's starring in the new film Mudbound alongside Carey Mulligan. Tim, this film seems to be one of the films that we'll be hearing about a lot more in the year ahead.
Mudbound really speaks, I think, to what is going on in the U.S. because it is about post-World War II America, where a white family and a Black family have to reluctantly work together on this farm in Mississippi. And what is sobering about the movie is that even though it's set, you know, about 60, 70 years ago, the themes of that movie, the idea of racial strife, economic inequality, and also a rise in sort of a white nationalist movement, that's all in the film, and that's all that we're seeing right now in the U.S. And some of those factors unquestionably led to Trump's election last year. And so watching Mudbound, I'm not the first person to say this, but you watch that movie and it feels so incredibly timely that it's almost kind of sickening to realize how far we haven't come in the last 60 or 70 years. It's a fine film and it has a very, very strong cast, but just also the themes of that movie are so resonant that I think a lot of people at Sundance, you know, make connections between what's going on in the real world and what they're actually seeing on the movie screen.
Tim Grierson at the New Republic magazine. Tim's one half of the magazine's own film podcast, Grierson and Leach. Staying on the topic of Sundance now, but let's cast our minds all the way back to 1999, when the idea of using the internet as a key marketing tool was still very much the stuff of novelties.
This is Burkittsville, formerly Blair. It is a small, quiet Maryland town, much like a small, quiet town anywhere. No more than 20 families laid their roots here over 200 years ago, many of whom remain either on this hill or in the town below.
On October 21st, 1994, Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Michael Williams hiked into Maryland's Black Hills Forest to shoot a documentary film on a local legend, the Blair Witch. They were never heard from again.
There are an unusually high number of children laid to rest here, most of whom passed in the 1940s. Yet no one in the town seems to recall anything unusual about this time. To us, anyway. Yet legend tells a different story. One whose evidence is all around us.
When the Blair Witch Project premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 1999, it ignited a sensation. With its crude production values and paperweight cast and crew, many saw it as little more than a cleverly crafted student film project. Certainly, no one expected it to gross nearly $250 million worldwide. But while the found footage technique proved ingeniously effective, it was another quiet force behind the film that really set things off. Marketing.
Where is he? Where are you? Come on, Josh. I hear him downstairs. Come on, I hear him downstairs. Come on, Josh.
Months before the film's premiere, a website was set up, blairwitch.com. In 1999, having a website for a film was already commonplace, but this website didn't seem to be advertising a film. Instead, it looked more like a hastily assembled collection of references to three missing teenagers. A quick search for Blair Witch on Alta Vista, Ask Jeeves, Yahoo, or indeed Google would return pages of news clippings, interviews, and photographs of the film's main protagonists. They'd all used their real names in the film, and if you checked IMDb, you'd find them listed as missing, presumed dead. Needless to say, Heather, Michael, and Joshua were not missing. There was no Blair Witch, and everyone involved was still very much alive. Years later, one of the actors, Heather Donahue, admitted that the ruse might have gone a little too far when her mother was inundated with sympathy cards and flowers from people convinced her daughter was dead.
Well, it doesn't happen much anymore, but when Blair Witch first came out, my mom kept getting sympathy cards. It was all part of their marketing scheme, so yeah, people thought I was dead. When people found out I was alive, a lot of them were kind of annoyed with me and wanted their money back.
Much of the film's marketing success seemed to be dependent upon Heather appearing to be dead. As she told PopCultureAddict.com, eventually the media frenzy became so intense that it drove her completely away from acting.
I went out into the desert with garbage bags full of old headshots, resumes, lingerie, stuff from previous relationships, photographs, magazine articles, and much of the media stuff surrounding Blair Witch, and I burnt it all.
Ask people today and you'll probably find few willing to admit that they may have fallen for the Blair Witch ruse. Maybe they didn't, but I remember seeing the film and not really knowing whether it was real or not. It certainly looked like it could be true. What's more likely is that most people were happy not to ask too many questions. The idea of a creepy witch haunting old woodlands and snatching teenagers comes right from the pages of classic horror lore. It could be true. The deceptive forces of clever marketing just made believing the story all the more tempting. Of course, the Blair Witch franchise was set for a reboot last year with the release of Blair Witch in September. The reviews, however, were not so good, so there's no word on another one just yet. Now let's bring ourselves back to the modern day now, because I'm joined by the editor of my favourite film magazine, Little White Lies, David Jenkins. David, you've devoted the current issue of the magazine to a film that's out in cinemas here in the United Kingdom and some other territories this week, Tony Erdmann. Now, I've read your review of the film and, well, I always love reading reviews of films for which the critics clearly hold a deep affection, but you've really, really loved this film, haven't you?
It's a kind of weird situation, really, because so many people have written about the film and, you know, it was in Cannes in May 2016. So since then, there's been this kind of drip feed of what the kind of Twitter community called hot takes. So when you're up to bat, particularly for a film like this, on which we're kind of dedicating, you know, 60 pages of editorial to, I think you've got to, you know, justify your choice there.
Yeah.
So I will say also that this isn't a case of like, oh, we're putting Tony Urban on the cover, we better just ladle on the hyperbole. This was from a genuine place.
Because I know you were looking forward to seeing that film at Cannes, even before anyone had really knew much about it. I mean, there was anticipation, wasn't there? People went to Cannes knowing, oh, I'm going to see Marin Arde's film. When did you decide to put it on the cover? When was that decision made? It's quite a big deal, considering how early on you must have to plan those covers.
I think sometimes it's just down to when a film is scheduled and there being a nice kind of synchronicity to that. I kind of have a little kind of Nixon's black book of films I want to put on the cover that I kind of keep with me at all times. So I think as soon as I saw that in Cannes, it kind of went on the list. A metaphorical book more than a literal one. So, but yeah, I think with the magazine, we're always trying to have a sort of diverse selection of cover films and try and make each magazine a kind of new experience in a sort of similar template, I guess.
By the end of it, you do feel like you've gone on some sort of character-driven journey, and that's quite common with films that end up running for this amount of time. There is so much time there for you to develop the character all the way through that by the end of it, you feel like you've actually watched that character go through some sort of really profound experience. The way that this is resolved, I think it does move you in quite an unexpected way, doesn't it?
If I was to pick a moment of the film, and I won't spoil it, but there is this incredible kind of modulation, I think you'd call it, where you go from a sequence which it's almost like a kind of slapstick sequence that is incredibly funny, and then within about 60 seconds you flip to a sequence where you want to cry because it's actually tremendously moving and toying with you. I mean, not toying with your emotions, but like going from these two extremes in such a short amount of time I think that is the essence of like a master filmmaker, someone who can do that in a believable way and who can make it seem profound and emotional and real all at once. And I don't want to sort of diss American comedies because I like them and they serve a function. I think
Absolutely.
This is something different.
Yeah.
This is like, I mean, I think what this film is, I mean, I think in interviews with the director Marin Arde, she's talked about this idea of, well, people have asked her, is this a comedy? And I don't think she likes that sort of generic term for it, because I think there is something just, I mean, it's about funny people doing funny things.
Yeah,
but
it's about the hilarity of everyday life.
Yeah, I mean, the film itself is more like Bergman or something. It's a human comedy in the kind of classical sense, I guess.
Hallo, wie geht's?
Ja, sehr gut eigentlich.
Sie sollen nicht so viel arbeiten.
Komm noch mal rein. Ich telefoniere noch.
Doch, telefoniert noch.
Ich habe jetzt jemand engagiert als Ersatztochter.
Part of the trailer for Marin Arde's new film, Tony Erdmann. It's been rolling out in theatres across the world since its premiere at Cannes last year. Still to come on The Cinema Show, you might have heard the term gaslighting to describe some of what's happening in the United States at the moment. We'll take a look at the 1944 film that coined the word. Stay tuned. Festival season is in full swing, with Sundance wrapping up and Berlin about to switch into gear. Meanwhile, the Rotterdam Film Festival was lighting up screens in the Netherlands this week. Among the films attracting attention was Super Dark Times, the debut film of director Kevin Phillips. Reviews praised the visually striking film and authentic scripting. And making quite a topical splash at the festival was This Is Our Land. The story revolves around a single mother in France who finds herself drifting into a circle of far-right politics after an encounter with a charismatic blonde leader. Obviously, comparisons were quickly made with real-life far-right leader and blonde Marine Le Pen, igniting some controversy. Of course, if you can't make it to Rotterdam, Park City or Berlin, you can always stay in with your very own at-home festival on Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. Screening right now in the United Kingdom is the creepy 1965 film Bunny Lake Is Missing from director Otto Preminger, which sees a confused young woman who may or may not be the victim of gaslighting as she searches frantically for her daughter. There's also the classic Australian mystery Picnic at Hanging Rock. And in the United States, there's a celebration of Derek Jarman's birthday with War Requiem, The Last of England and Blue.
Get a whole month of movies for free right now by logging on to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Now, if you've been reading the political pages in the United States lately, you might have noticed the word gaslighting creeping into the op-eds. The term has often been applied to politics, but its origin lies somewhere else entirely.
Where did you find that?
In this score. She must have left it here. It's written by somebody called Sergius Bauer.
Give it to me.
He said I wasn't any litter. He said I was going out of my mind.
You're not going out of your mind. You're slowly and systematically being driven out of your mind.
But why? Why?
The setting is old London. The winter fog hangs low throughout the cold, empty streets surrounding Paula's home at No. 9 Thornton Square. Some years earlier, this beautiful terrace house was the scene of a murder. Her aunt, a celebrated opera singer, was found strangled, her killer never found. Now married to the handsome Gregory Anton, Paula returns to London and to the cold, empty house that's laid uninhabited since that terrifying night. Despite her wish to find a home in Paris, her new husband insists that confronting her fears at the scene of her aunt's murder will ultimately be good for her. But she soon starts forgetting things, trivial things like appointments. Objects vanish from the house without explanation, and her husband's demeanor becomes even darker than the dimly gaslit home. MGM's 1944 adaptation of Gaslight, starring Ingrid Bergman, is not a ghost story, though it certainly feels like one. Based upon the 1938 play by Patrick Hamilton, the story finds an innocent and completely sane young woman made to believe all the strange occurrences happening around her are actually of her own making. The American version of the film was nominated for 7 Oscars, including Angela Lansbury for Best Supporting Actress in her screen debut, and a Best Actress win for Ingrid Bergman.
Winner to Ingrid Bergman for her performance in MGM's Gaslight.
Congratulations, Ingrid. Your artistry has won our votes, and your graciousness has won our hearts.
Thank you very much for my Oscar, and I hope that in the future I'll be worthy of it.
A film's language entering common vernacular is certainly not unheard of, but the popularity of Gaslight went one step further by coining a term that would enter the realm of clinical psychology.
The crucial feature of gaslighting is the blatant telling of lies again and again and again in a way that makes the listener start to question their own reality, right? If Donald Trump is saying these untruths so confidently and so repeatedly, we start to worry about whether what we think is true actually is true. In the original movie, it's about the gas lights are flickering and the wife insists that these lights keep flickering, and her husband, who is causing the lights to flicker, just denies it and convinces her that she's going insane.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Howard, a lecturer in political theory at University College here in London. He says that a key aspect of gaslighting in the real world is not to entirely fabricate a story, but rather to distort reality just enough so that it seems to support a set of, well, shall we say, alternative facts.
I think that's probably right. I think there's always a seed of truth in the things that most liars say that gives them some traction in the real world, and so makes it possible for the victim to start wondering whether he or she is really right to be reacting in this way. I mean, I think that Donald Trump has been doing this for years. I mean, we certainly saw it during the campaign. I think one of the most memorable quotes from one of the debates with Hillary Clinton was when Hillary said, "Donald, I know you live in your own reality." And that was truer than she knew, which is that Donald Trump has a set of claims he makes regularly. I have no idea whether he actually knows that they're untrue, or more likely whether he just doesn't care whether they're true or not. But he repeats them again and again, and they're often contradictory.
To gaslight someone doesn't simply mean engaging in manipulation to get your own way or swindling an old lady for her cash. Gaslighting involves repeated behavior designed to cause a victim to question their reality, the denial of something that clearly just happened, or an abuser blaming their actions on their victim. It's perhaps unsurprising then that Gaslight, the film and terminology, has found renewed relevance now. In the film, gaslighting is all part of a plot to gain hold of some precious jewels. In reality, its use spreads far beyond treasure hunters. Mental health professionals cite its commonality in cases of narcissism. The hunger for control results in the victim being completely dependent on their abuser for any sense of reality. It's a situation explored in the slightly ridiculous film Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, in which Betty Davis, camping it up even more than she'd previously done in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. In this case, however, the perpetrators exploit the already emotionally unstable Charlotte, making her believe that her mental state is to blame for her changing circumstances.
You do as I tell you, and if I tell you to lie, you'll do that too. I'm never going to suffer for you again. Not ever. Do you understand?
Both of these films present gaslighting as part of an elaborately premeditated swindle, but the technique needn't be so perfectly planned or even consciously executed. Consider the literacy tests that were once mandatory before many black Americans were allowed to vote, with instructions like draw a line around the number or letter of this sentence and spell backwards, forwards. Those who couldn't complete the quiz might have walked away thinking that they perhaps weren't as clever as they thought. In the 1944 film, Ingrid Bergman's character eventually realizes that she's not losing grip of her sanity and, with the help of Joseph Cotton, turns the tables on her shady husband. In reality, holding on to what's real might not be so easy. That's all for this week's program. Next week, we'll be reporting from the Berlin Film Festival and we'll celebrate Valentine's Day with a few films that give love stories just a bit of a reality check. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.